April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Tim Arsenault has a laugh that you won't forget and a cast you'll want to master. An avid angler and competitor at the popular Spearama casting event, he has made a much-deserved name for himself as one of North America's top casters. Tim is the founder of Bridge Fly Lines and the manager of Vancouver's Michael & Young Fly Shop. In this episode of Anchored, Tim shares the story of how he got started fishing and eventually competing. We discuss the stresses behind starting a fly line company and take a closer look at some of the advanced casting techniques that Tim uses for distance. I'll be posting this episode up on YouTube if you prefer to watch Tim's form while you listen. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by South Dakota and their incredible hunting opportunities. In South Dakota, hunting is a shared legacy, something everyone can be a part of. That's why they're focused on making their fields a welcome place for everyone. See how at huntthegreatestsd.com, where you can hear stories from sportsmen and women and learn what makes South Dakota the world's pheasant capital. While you're there, check out public land maps, hunting blogs, and seasonal information for one unforgettable fall. Learn more at www.huntthegreatestsd.com. You're not really one to talk about yourself, so I figure I'm going to just pin you down. Literally okay. Stick you in a corner and ask you questions.
Okay, sure. Fire away. I'll do my best.
We'll start where we start everyone. So where were you born and raised?
I was born in Summerside, Prince Edward Island in 1978 in August. But my parents moved us to Calgary at a pretty young age. I think I did preschool there, but I've spent pretty much my entire adult life here in entire childhood and adult life in British Columbia. We lived in South Surrey for a while and then moved into sort of the Cloverdale area, Cloverdale Langley area. And I kind of grew up in that area for most of my teenage years and into my early 20s. And now I live downtown Vancouver.
Right. So how did the whole fishing thing start?
Yeah, that's a funny story. So, my parents they're not like outdoor people. They've never been big on camping or fishing or anything like that. Good folks, but that just was never their thing. But you know, when we were quite young, we would find our way down to the local streams in South Surrey to sort of throw worms on the bottom with spinning rods and stuff like that. So there was always like a little element of fishing, but it never really started until in any kind of serious way. Until I met my friend. Well, I'd known him for a couple of years, my friend Matt in high school. And it must have been his birthday or something, but he had a car before everybody else. And so my mom always called him Eddie Haskell because he'd come into my mom's house and kind of be like, "Oh, Mrs. Arsenault, what do you have? What's that I smell cooking? You have such a wonderful home." And then the second she'd turn her back, he'd, you know, "Let's skip school and go do this or that," right? So anyway, the way it kind of started was he wanted to skip school and go fishing. And then I didn't have any of the real fishing gear for the real rivers. And so he would always have his dad's stuff sort of in the trunk of that car. And so we started out doing that. And then, we both probably had, we took the different route in life where we both got kicked out of school. I got sentenced to sort of the bad kid program and, he showed up there a couple months later and then, we picked up right where we left off, skipping that to go fishing. And then I finished school later on my own accord, but it was, that's sort of how it all started for sure. And it was pretty casual at first, but then as time went on, as anyone probably listening to this podcast would know, it sort of gets into your blood a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And then the fly fishing thing, was that your buddy as well, or was that just a natural progression for you?
He definitely was the first one to expose me to it. He had an old Sage RPL 9 foot 5 weight, and I tried casting it a couple times. But no, I just found it naturally. It just sort of came along probably at when it does for everyone. You've done a bunch of gear fishing, you know, steelhead and salmon, but in particular steelhead was a big thing for me. And so, I used to fish quite a bit with gear for them. And then of course, when you catch quite a few, and back when I was doing that, there was quite a few fish around. And if you were there all the time, you'd catch it, more than a few usually. So I wanted a harder way to do it, and fly fishing seemed to be a good way to get that.
So your first steelhead trip then, or your first successful steelhead trip, was that the Vetter, the Chilliwack, the Thompson?
No,
where were you?
No, that was a summer on steelhead on the Chehalis. Yeah, Chehalis River in Mission. Yeah, yeah. We had hiked into the canyon and we were fishing bait in there, and ended up getting a fish in there, and that's what started it all. Yeah.
Oh, no wonder why you're hooked. That's crazy. It's super magical in there.
Yeah, it's super,
super
cool.
Are we allowed to talk about that? I wonder if I should not be. No, it's horrible. It's awful.
It's terrible.
No,
don't go there.
No fish in that river. Yeah.
Nothing there. Yeah, plus I'm not in any shape to hike into it anymore. So pretty canyonous place, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not easy. I just remember you being in the blue Jeep. Do you remember your blue Jeep?
Yeah, 100%.
And you were a menace. I saw you everywhere. Everywhere I was fishing, there was Tim in his blue Jeep.
Blue Jeep, yeah.
So
I love
you
that
would have been, yeah. But it's funny. I don't know why. This is going to be really bad, what I'm about to say. And
okay,
don't. I'm sorry in advance, but
oh, it's okay.
I always thought you were like this goody kid. I would never have lumped you in the bad kid program.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess at that point I'd found fishing. I was pretty happy. But I mean, I've always been happy. I just got around. I probably hung out with some of the wrong kids.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's that's how you get the fun stories, right? So
right. It's water under the bridge, which actually I'm excited to talk to you about. Okay. Bridge. For people listening right now who don't know what I'm referring to, it'll make sense in just a minute. But first, so the Thompson, tell me about your first trip up to the Thompson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember the first trip to the Thompson. I think that was like, I think it was like 2000. I went to the Thompson, and we had heard, like, I used to fish at Gill's Tackle and, I used to shop at Gill's Tackle in Langley, and I'd hear the guys working in there talk about it. And then my friend had been shopping at Fred's a bunch, and he had ended up going with Peter McPherson, who worked at Fred's for a lot of years.
As soon as
he got back, he told me he went, and I was like, oh man, like, you got to take me, like, you know, you got to take me up there. Cause it always had so much lore. You'd hear so much about it. And then we went, and it was super cold. You know, I was fishing with a 10-foot 8-weight. We caught nothing. In fact, it took me about 4 years to get that first fish. And it's not an easy, like, it's a funny place. Cause every year that I would go back, I'd always kind of be like, oh man, I can't wait to get back there. I can't wait. Like, it's going to be so great. Like, that's my home. That's my favorite place to be. And then after about 3 days of fishing it, your knees and your ankles and your hips and no fish and the wind and nowhere to eat. And like, you're just like, man, why do I like this place so much? Right. You know, it was always like a rough place to be, but that first trip, I quickly found out how slippery it was. And actually I got a funny picture from that first trip. It was Matt again, the guy who I had originally fished with that I'd gone up with, and we didn't know where to go. Peter had showed him a few spots, but we didn't know the names of any of them or anything. And, you know, it was really cold and the river was really low. And so we pulled into the Y Run parking lot and the river was low, and the top corner looked really good, like it always does. So we were like, oh man, that looks pretty good. And I think Matt had already almost fallen in once. So we were kind of like, oh, it looks a little bit easy. Like, maybe we won't have to get in so deep to fish it. And he went out and caught this really nice resident trout. It wasn't, you know, and as you know, April, there's really nice trout in there as well. And sometimes they kind of fool you when you're there fishing in the fall. And so he got that fish and he held it up, and he was working at a fireplace door manufacturer at the time. And he, So you could smoke in there. You know, this back in the days where you could smoke just about anywhere. And I'll never forget, he got in the car that morning and he had a huge burn between his eyes, a huge blister. And I guess he was doing something. He had his safety goggles down around his chin. He was doing something at work and they flipped up and he had a cigarette in his mouth and pinned it right between his eyes. So I got this picture of him with this trap, with this giant blister right between his eyes. Yeah. So I still got that picture. That's a good one. But I kept going back and it took a number of years, but I finally got a fish and then there was a few more after that and loved fishing there. You know, I think you would probably agree that place, if you were there enough, it kind of shaped, like, I guess I can only speak for myself, it kind of shaped who I am as an angler. And probably during those years, you know, when you're that age or whatever, it's probably the persistence you need to catch fish there, or to just stick it out until something comes along, probably shapes you a little bit as a person as well.
Yeah, for sure. Where did you used to stay?
I used to stay at Vera's. So, like, I don't know if you remember, but beside...
Yes, it's you. Yeah. You're the reason. So the reason I started staying at the Hilltop was because I went into the Log Cabin pub and John and Lori were like, it's my first time up there. They're going, you're not staying. Well, it was my first time steelhead fishing. I used to sleep in my car when I'd go trout fishing in the summer, but it was cold.
Right.
And they said, you're not staying at the Hilltop. We're going to call Vera.
Yeah.
And Vera had steelheaders already booked in.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't get me in, and it was a good, romping on up.
It was a good spot. She's got this like she's passed now, but she had this magnificent log cabin kind of right beside, I think it was like kind of right beside Rumors in town there, and between Log Cabin and Rumors, and she had this giant basement suite that must have had 7 or 8 beds in it anyway. And then there was TV. Oh yeah. And then there was a big barbecue out back. She had a giant parking lot. So if anyone wanted to, or like a driveway or whatever. So if anyone wanted to bring their boat or whatever it was, there was a lot of room for it. And it was great. She was really a funny lady and opened our home to us. And it was a good spot for sure. And then, you know, I did a lot of just day trips too. Like a lot of people who know me to go up there. I'd work so much that, you know, a lot of times I'd only get sort of like a Saturday. So I would get up at sort of like 3:30 in the morning and rip up to Spence's Bridge and fish all day and then turn around and come back. And people are always kind of like, well, why do you do that? And I'd be like, well, if I don't do it, I don't fish. So I'm going to do it. Right. So yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's super cool. It's all the little pieces that I've known about you over the years are all kind of coming together, which is kind of fun. Because, you know, you're a super fishy guy. And so I was always quite surprised to hear that you took on competition casting. And a lot of people tuning in right now may know of you through that scene. And I think competitive casters get lumped into this category of not really being anglers. And I don't think that's necessarily fair. And I wanted to navigate those waters with you here a little bit. So what got you into it? What was the big reason that you decided to start fishing competitions and casting long lines?
I guess like a lot of my students or people I've taught or even people I've talked to in the shop over the years, a lot of times I say that spey casting kind of ruined my life. The first good cast I had, which was not long after I got my first setup, like there was just something that popped in my brain. And I'm just one of those people. I don't get to choose what I like. Like it just, whatever it is, it just sort of pops out of nowhere. I'm just one of those people that tends to follow that. And so, with the casting, you know, the casting was just always a really big part of the whole thing, the whole package of it. Like, the first time I saw someone fly cast, I definitely kind of took notice of that. And that, I mean, I just knew how beautiful it sort of looked, and there was a whole mystique to it that was really interesting. And then the first time I saw a guy with a two-handed rod, that was like, whoa, holy, like I was fishing in the canal. And it was probably like in March or April. It was a really nice day. And this guy just sort of like came down the other bank one of the steep banks with this really super long rod, and it looked almost like an Islander steelheader center pin, but looking back, it must have been like an Islander FR2 or just a big gold sort of reel. And I didn't think much of it. I just thought I was center pin guy or whatever. And he got in there and yeah, I'd never seen anything like it. Like he just kind of do these magical little sweeps of the rod, and whoever he was, I'd love to know, because he was really good. And those reels had really loud checks on them. So it was funny. He got down there and I wasn't really paying attention. I'm just sort of fishing, and I can hear him pulling line off. And then I was kind of a little bit confused, because then I kind of thought maybe it was a fly rod, but the rod looked really big. And then I just kind of went back to fishing, and I heard the reel go kind of like, and I kind of like glanced down, and I saw his cast turning over near the far bank. And it was he was such a good caster that it was the reel or the line just sort of hitting the reel. And I remember just watching him go down the run as the sun sort of went down. And every time this guy would cast, it was just like, and it's just sailing across the river. And so I was like, what the heck is that? I've never seen anything like that before. So I ran into Mike Lynn Young, and Dave was there, and I was kind of like, man, what was that? What was that? Right. And so he described it to me. And so then I had to have one. And then when I got one, like I fell in love with it right away. And then that first good cast, really something switched in my brain. And it wasn't just the fishing at that point anymore. It was the casting. I always liked single-handed casting, but it was spey casting that really kind of changed it for me. And then anything, I mean, for me, anyway, the things that I love, I want to learn more about them. So going and competing in tournaments was really a way for me to, just get like, try and learn about what it is that I like so much and to try and just be better at it.
Obviously you've heard people say that casters and fishers are two separate things. What are your thoughts on that?
I've seen that for sure. Like, there's this guy, really great guy, amazing caster. His name's Rory Costello. He doesn't compete anymore. You might have even met him, April. He's an Irish guy, because I'd seen you at Speyorama a couple times. But he kind of stopped competing a few years back. But you know, he fished, but not with a two-handed rod. And he got like third and I think second 1 year. And I would always talk to him and just be like, oh yeah, no, have you, like, do you fish salmon? You're in Ireland? And no. And I'd be like, well, why? He's like, it just never interested me. Just okay. Like, but he was a big brown trout fisherman, and he had a lock very close to his place. And he was just fanatical about this mayfly hatch that would happen on this lock. And he loved brown trout fishing, but he was a guy who was easily one of the best casters in the world, and had no interest in fishing a two-handed rod for anadromous species. So I never really got into it with him about like how we found it. I'm sure that's really quite an interesting story as well. But I will say that most of the guys that I know that compete are pretty good anglers. And I mean, if you go down the list and have a look, I mean, even going back, like Steve Choate, amazing fisherman. Greg Bensavinga, Brian Stiskel. I mean, I don't know. The list goes on. I've never fished with guys like James Chalmers in Scotland, but I've seen all the pictures. He's clearly a great angler. Tommy Arkvisa always seems to be catching fish when I follow his Instagram. Geir Hansen's another one. So in my experience, I think a lot of the guys are good anglers. And I think, I would say that most are good anglers. Yeah. I mean, I don't, outside of Rory, pretty much everyone I know, down there found, spey casting, from fishing. But I do think there is probably a difference between casting and fishing. I think most of us would somewhat agree to that. Like you need to fish to cast, or you need to cast to fish. And there's certain places where a long cast is pretty beneficial. But certainly you can overcast fish too in a lot of situations. And I think that's the great thing about tournament casting for me, is that outside of the Thompson, I didn't have a lot of places where a really long cast would catch you a fish. Most places it was more detrimental than a benefit. And on the Thompson, there was certainly a lot of places too where those kind of casts weren't required, and maybe even would catch you less fish if you weren't going to the right spots. So I think knowing when to do it is good. But the great thing about the tournament casting is it gave me an outlet to cast far, so that I wasn't doing that when I was fishing as much, because before I went tournament casting, the only time I'd be casting, I'd be on the river and I'd be fishing. And so, you know, I'd get into the wide tail out, and instead of fishing it kind of inside, I'd be like, oh man, I just want to cast, see if I'm any better than last time. And I'm sure some of the people that fished behind me were pretty stoked to have me do that. A lot of my friends caught fish behind me for sure, but it gave me an arena to do it so that I don't do it while I fish as much. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, 'cause while you were talking about all those, you know, you're listing off all those names, I totally agree. The best casters I know are all fantastic anglers. So I don't really know where it comes from. And the reason why I asked you is because I remember fishing with Steve Rajeff, and granted, this is a single hand thing, but I could tell that it was a soft spot for him as an angler, that people have said to him before, oh, but he can't really fish. He's more of a caster, but he's an exceptional angler. So I could just tell in listening to him speak that it was a bit of a soft spot. And I didn't know if you'd experienced anything like that.
I mean, you hear it all for sure. Yeah. But none of it matters. You know, most of the guys, I mean, if anyone's interested, I'd say they are really good anglers for the most part. You know, I'm probably one of the least skilled anglers of that group. I think a lot of those guys probably catch a lot more fish than I do. That's for sure.
So let's go back to, you know, what would this have been, 10, 15? I feel like in looking at my timeline, it's about 15 years ago when I remember you going down to the Fraser River and focusing specifically on casting. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Yeah. I started competing in, it was 2010 or 2011. I think it was 2010, I think. So it's going back about, well, I guess 12, this spring would be probably, I guess, 13 years. So yeah, that's pretty bang on. That was probably right about then. And there was a couple of years before I went that I kind of thought to myself, hey, you shouldn't go down there and have no practice. Maybe you should give it a shot. So like, just practice some before you go. Right. So nothing could have prepared me. No amount of practice could have prepared me for what I saw when I went. But I definitely gave it a bit of practice before I went, for sure.
Wait, so your first time ever at Spayorama, you were competing? You didn't just go and check it out?
No, I went in there. Yeah, I just went right in. Yeah.
Okay, so how does it look? How do you register? Just the whole thing. Tell me the entire experience. I'm assuming you drove down with your, what's your wife's name? Lisa?
Lisa. Yeah. Yeah.
So you and Lisa would have driven down. Okay. Then what happens?
So we drove down. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's a good story. So Bob Miser, hello, Bob, if Bob's listening. Bob was the first sort of guy to support me in the whole tournament thing. And so he had made me a rod for going down there. And so he was kind of like, man, like you got to drop by on your way through. If you're coming through Medford, maybe stay the night. And so I did. And we had a great time. You know, it was great to meet him and stay there. And he's such an awesome guy. And so we went on from there and got down to San Francisco. The club isn't super easy to find in the park, especially back then. I mean, we didn't have like the map on the phone and all the rest of it. So we were kind of driving around the park for a while, and we finally figured out it was across from the bison paddock. So we went in there, and it's like, as you know, it's just a really neat place. Like there's definitely a magical sort of feel to the whole thing. And there's the smell of like eucalyptus, and their forest just smells different than ours. Later on, I found out the eucalyptus, they're invasive, believe it or not, but I guess that makes sense. But a guy told me that. But just the smell and everything. And I remember we parked in the parking lot, and I didn't know what I was going to see. But I could kind of hear from the parking lot. Like when you're in the parking lot and you're getting out of your car and you're getting ready to go up, you can, if there's a lot of really good casters in there, you can kind of hear this like noise. And that's people's rods coming forward and stopping. And so I was like hearing that, and I'm like, oh wow, there must be a bunch of people down there. And so there's a path that goes, if you're in the parking lot, there's a path that goes sort of to the left and you go by the clubhouse, the proper, and you kind of come down to the ponds from there. And then there's a trail on the right or on the west side of the parking lot that leads to like more to the west side, to the west pond. And so I'm walking up the trail and I'm hearing all this stuff and I'm kind of like wondering what I'm going to see. And I get up to the top, I'm almost to the top of the trail, and this leader comes flying down the trail and this yarn sort of like lands at my feet. And so I just kind of stop. I'm like, oh man, like that's kind of weird, piece of yarn. So then I take a few more, you know, the yarn starts getting retrieved away, and I take a couple more steps and I get to the top of the trail, and I can see a guy at the far end of the West Pond who's cast all the way down the West Pond and like down the trail a ways. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh man, like back to the drawing board. I definitely can't do that. And so, it wasn't intimidating too much. I mean, it is a little bit, but it wasn't too much because I've always been a pretty big fan of learning. So I knew that I was going to learn a lot. And, I remember too that, like Bruce Kruk, another awesome dude, I was like pretty nervous about going in there for my first time. I think anyone probably will be. And he had the greatest advice. You know, we were kind of like waiting to go in, and I think he could tell that I was like visibly nervous. And so he's just got such a great way. He walks up and he's like, you nervous? And I'm like, yeah, I'm really nervous. And he's like, what for? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, we're not going to win, man. Don't even worry about it. Like, you know what? That guy over there, he won last year and he's defending. And then those two guys got second, third. They're trying to get first. You don't even worry about it. Like, this is the mulligan. This is the one. Just go out and have fun. Right. And that, like, as soon as he said that, like, it was great because that's exactly what was going to happen. I knew from my week being there that, you know, it's no mystery. Your stuff's landing here. Their stuff's landing way over here. So you know that you're not going to, you know, light the world on fire that first year. So as soon as he said that, I really relaxed and it made the whole thing a lot more enjoyable. And then it just sort of went from there. I just sort of kept going back.
How'd you do the first year?
I got 14th. I got the first year. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Not too bad.
That's excellent.
It wasn't bad for a first try, for sure.
Wow. Okay. So you said that Bob made you a rod. What's the difference between a standard, say, 14-foot-8 weight steelhead rod and a competition rod?
Yeah. So, I mean, number one is just like the weight of the lines that they're meant to handle. So, typically your tournament lines are going to be, sort of in the range of like, let's say 980 grains up to 1150 or even more. Everyone's pretty, you know, pretty, well, not everyone, but a lot of people are sort of secret squirrel about what they're doing with their lines and how heavy they are and how long they are. You can deduce a little bit of that from being observant when you're there, but there's certainly guys that are on the long and heavy end of the spectrum, and certainly guys that are on the shorter, lighter end of the spectrum. But at the end of the day, they're grain weights that you're not seeing in your typical fishing rods. These would be like 12 weights or even more. At Spayorama, there's a 15-foot, 1-inch maximum. So 15 feet isn't that uncommon a rod. So, I mean, in length, they're not too uncommon. I think in the amount of grains they're meant to throw, they are. And you know what's funny? I practiced with my tournament rods for so long that I think I found them kind of heavy in the beginning. And then for a lot of years, it just didn't feel like all that, like it just, I don't know, it didn't feel as heavy. I think that's because I practiced so much. And then these last 2 years with the pandemic, I haven't practiced at all. And I had a good thing come out with a tournament rod. He wanted some pointers. And I was like, man, this thing is heavy, right? So I'm going to have to get back and fight in shape if I want to go back down there. But I guess after my last experience, I'd have to say, yeah, they're probably a little heavier than your typical rod too. Yeah.
So how far does that line extend then? 1150, that's a huge amount of weight. What's the head length on a typical competition line?
So the ones that that a lot of us use will be uncut around 80 feet. And I can't remember what they weigh in at, but they're usually way over what you need. And then what you do is you cut those lines from the back where they're thick until it gets to where you like it, basically. And most people are probably going to end up between like 69 and 74 feet. That's where a lot of folks end up with their lines. And there certainly was a time where a lot of people were like gluing lines together and doing funny stuff because there wasn't as many tournament lines available. But by the time I got there, there was certainly a couple fishing lines. Like my first tournament line was given to me by Steve Godshall, and that one was definitely welded together from some different stuff. And then I think the next year I bought a Karen 95 1112, which is a really long, heavy line. And I cut that one from the back till it got into that range. And then it wasn't long after that James Chalmers started his own company. And James, a longtime competitor, started his company, Gale Force, and they came out with a great tournament line, which I used right from the beginning. And that one's 80 feet, and I can't remember how many grains to start with, but it's got to be like maybe 1300. It's up there. And then I was always cut mine. I was always a little bit on the shorter end of things, so I actually liked like 69 to 71 feet. Like I liked it a little shorter and a little lighter. And so yeah, so those lines were that was kind of the beginning of like when I first got there. We were, you know, the commercially available lines were kind of available. I don't think you had to glue and splice and weld things together as much. And those lines, the taper on the front is sort of like what it is. And then the back of the line, there's a lot of like level heavy stuff. And so you're just cutting the level heavy stuff at the back to get things into the length and weight that you want it to be. And then there's certainly folks out there that are taking pieces out of the middle and putting other pieces in and changing things. But I never did a lot of that. I always use the Gale Force lines, although there's lots of good tournament lines out there. Lee Davidson, the ballistic one's great. Gene Oswald has his Boss line. That's awesome. I like the Gale Force one. There's great lines out there. I just gravitated to that one. It seemed to work well for me. You just sort of cut them until they're good. And that's going to be different for everyone. I mean, if you're like me and like 5'10", and my arms being the length they are, you know, it's possible that you may like something shorter. And if you're 6'6", you may like something longer. But I can't even really equate that to that, because there's certainly people that are my size there or height that use longer lines than I've used in the past.
Coming up, Tim and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to South Dakota for supporting this episode of Anchored. For more than 100 years, pheasant hunting has been a storied South Dakota tradition. Now, for the next century, South Dakota is focused on expanding pheasant hunting's horizons, welcoming more sportswomen to the field, giving them a greater voice in the hunting community. That's a legacy to stand the test of time. If you haven't already, check them out at huntthegreatestst.com. Can you explain to people listening, excuse me, how to splice a line?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't done a lot of that in a long time because for tournament casting, you don't need things to be really strong because you're not going to be having a fish pulling on it. So when I want to put a couple pieces of line together, what I do is I cut the two pieces of line on a really fine bias. So I try and get like a long sort of like 30 degree angle on both of them. And then I put super glue on either of them and I just stick them together. And then once it's there, I coat it all in super glue and I just sort of dab it on a paper towel and I let it dry. And that's not for fishing, but you know, that you can put a line together that way. And if you're using it in a pond, or something like that, you're going to be fine. When it came to core splicing, I did a little bit of that early on, and that involves sort of like you get a pin and you put it in the vise with the you see this is going back. So you put it in the vise with the point in the fly tying vise with the point facing forward. And what you do is you work it in, you know, you've got the line you want to splice to. So you try and work that needle point right into the core of that line, and you get it a couple inches in, and then you kind of bend the line 90 degrees and push it, and the needle comes through. So then it's been a while. So then what you do is, yeah, so you take it out of the vise and you get some dental floss and you put a loop of it in the needle and pull that through. And now you've got a loop sticking out the other way. And then how did I do it again? I think it's the opposite way. You get the loop going through the other way. And then you have another piece of core that you strip. You put that into the dental floss and you yank it through. Usually you coat it in super glue before you yank it through. And then you trim it and you coat the whole thing in super glue. And then I would actually go over the top of it with AquaSeal. And if you do that, you can hang off of that thing. Like if you do it right, you just pull on it and it just never comes apart. But yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, you get the loop through, then I think you put the other one in, pull it through. There's definitely instructions out there. You're making me reach back the annals of time on that way.
It's hard too. But it's hard just doing it while sitting there
to pull it through.
No, but I've totally got a visual. I see what you mean. So you have to splice the core to be able to fish with it. You can't just super glue your line together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, speaking of line construction, you've gone ahead and started your own fly line company.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah, I did that.
Bridge. And I was actually reading the about before I hopped on the call with you, because I've known about Bridge, and obviously because it's you, I trust the lines, but I thought, well, I should just read a little bit, you know, why that he named it Bridge.
Sure.
I love the story behind it. Can you tell people the story behind Bridge and what it stands for, all that fun stuff?
Yeah. We did a lot of brainstorming. Like everything I do, I agonize over it. And the name and the logo were no exception to that. There was a lot of different names that were thrown around, and I would ask everyone. And you know, it's so funny. It's when you're asking people what the name of a company is going to be, doesn't matter. There's always going to be people that look at you with like a scrunched up look on their face and they don't get it. And then there'll be people like, man, that's awesome, right? So you get sort of the full sort of spectrum. But one night we were in the shop here, and my buddy Zach came in, and I think Aaron was working at the time too. My buddy Aaron Goodis, who shoots all the photos for the brand and does all the videos for the brand. And we were just, again, you know, I was hassling everyone about the name, what the name of this thing was going to be. And we were just sort of throwing stuff away. And it started with Spence's Bridge, because we were like, oh, wouldn't it be cool? Like Spence's Bridge Line Company or like something like that. And then we were kind of like, oh, I know, but the Thompson, like, yeah, it's closed and everything. And not everyone's going to get it and this and that. And then I can't remember which of the three of us said it. It was just like, what about Bridge? And we didn't even really go into it too much. And so everyone left, and I don't know, it just sort of stuck. And then I thought about it over a couple of days, and then you read their website. I mean, the more that I thought about it, the more that it really made sense. That, you know, yeah, bridges are just, they're like a lot of the things that I wanted my company to be could be, you know, thought of it in bridge terms. You know, when I first started, I made my first line was my main stem, which was my long one. And I wanted that to be a modern take on a traditional line. And so bridges can be thought of, you know, symbolic of going from the past into the future. They can be symbolic of technology and nature. They can, you know, which a line is as well. When you're casting a line like that into the water, it's modern technology being used in nature. There's strength connotations. You know, bridges are meeting points. They're put-ins, they're takeouts. They're the past, they're the future. And they're like every, But most iconic rivers that you're going to fish have an iconic bridge over it. And a lot of us use those bridges as contacts when we're talking about where we're going to meet people or where we're going to go or where, what we're going to do, right? You know, and not every river has an iconic bridge over it, but enough of them do, that's for sure. And so, like, the more I thought about it, the more it just made sense. And so we just went with it. We just kind of went with it for sure. And it's a good fit, I think. I love it.
And you're cool. You're bridging the gap. I mean, I know for me and I'm not just saying this. I'm intimidated by long lines. And when the time comes for me to go and get a longer line, I'm going to come and get one of your lines because I know that you will absolutely put a modern spin on it. So before I start asking you questions about how you started the company and what that even looks like as far as sourcing, what do you mean by putting a modern or having a modern take on a maybe more traditional line? Can you explain to us what a traditional line would look like and maybe the complications of that and how you are looking to maybe make it easier for people?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the long lines of my past are not the long lines of the super long ago past. So by the time I started spay casting, weight forward commercially available lines were already out there. But my first run-ins with long lines were the Scientific Angler Mastery Spay, the Mid Spay, the Grand Spay, the XLT. They were sort of the legendary long heads of my day. And when I first started, I didn't start with lines like that. You know, the Windcutter and the Delta were out at that point. You know, funny enough, we consider those long today, but back in those days, guys make fun of you for using them, right? So, so those lines were modern at the time. But when I think about line design, and I think about what, you know, in my time, in my context, what would have been considered traditional, those would have been it. And so the lengths are really kind of, you know, previous to all the long lines, the weight forward lines, a lot of people use double tapers. That was pretty common. And so I have double tapers now that I do definitely throw around for fun. But we were past that era by the time I kind of got involved. And so, to me, the long lines of the past, they just didn't have that. I guess when I think about a modern twist that has to do with my time in tournament casting. So when I went to tournament casting, I had cast long lines that I had done. I wasn't super good at it, but I had done it. And when I went down there and I started casting tournament lines right from the very first one, I knew that this was like a race car. Like what I had had before was a great fishing line, but the lines that I have encountered over the decade or however long it's been of me competing, they just took that stuff and turned it on its head. You know, like I was just really wowed by the amount of line speed and efficiency these things had. And so that really made me take a step back and go like, whoa, these are next level, right? And I think, you know, through explorations of tournament lines and tournament casting, you get really curious about what makes the line feel that way. And so you go on this exploration of trying to figure out why the line does what it does. And you start seeing design differences. For me, I started graphing the lines. So I would, you know, measure them. And my really good buddy, James Reed, maker of bamboo rods in Vancouver Island, you know, he was the one that showed me how to measure a line and put it on a graph and look at it. Right. And so I started doing that. And of course, if you do that to a whole bunch of lines, from both the past and the present and stuff you like, and even some stuff you don't like, you're going to notice some differences for sure. And you notice some stark differences in some of the tournament stuff. And so the idea was just, you know, like a lot of these great companies like Boss or Nextcast or Gale Force or Ballistic, those tournament developments that make those lines turbocharged sort of they trickle down into the everyday drivers, the fishing stuff, right? And so for me, it was more about that traditional length, but with modern energy, if that makes sense, like a level of line speed and turnover and distance potential that I didn't see in some of those older lines that I fished.
Right. Okay. And I am going to pick your brain more about this later because I've got a bunch of real nerdy questions for you, but we'll save those for later.
Sure.
How did you do this? I mean, you don't just walk down the street to the local fly line factory. How did you get started? I know you can't share too many secrets, but...
I can share lots. yeah. So, I mean, I had, you know... James had showed me, you know, how to measure a line, how to look at it, how to put it on a graph and see the shape of it. And then I had been in the industry for a while from before that. So I had a big sort of like, I don't know, I guess it was a bit of like just meant to be because I never threw any spay line I ever owned out, no matter how cracked or destroyed, or if I didn't like it, it just went all into this drawer. And so I had this drawer full of spay lines and then all the stuff that I was using currently. And so I just started graphing everything and just looking at all of it and trying to figure out why things did what they did. And I'm not sure I figured that out even now. I certainly have a ton to learn, and the designs I've done, I've really liked them, but even I'm like sometimes a little unsure about how I got there. I think there's still a lot of like unexplained things for me in fly line design. But I know I like what I've designed, and I just keep whacking away at it until I get something that I really like. But yeah, I mean, it kind of started, I wanted something a little on the longer side. Something that, you know, it wasn't too overpowered. It wouldn't have like a really overt weight sort of feel to it. I wanted it to hearken to those traditional lines, but also have a very modern feel to it. So I just started playing around with stuff and basically I glued a line together. I mean, that's how it started. So before, when I was telling you about how I cut the lines on a bias and I glue them together, that's how I make every one of my lines when I design them. So what I do is I get on a graph and I design the shape of the line, and then I go into my line library. So all these old lines that I have, and it's grown, like all my friends now that know that I do this, they're like, I got an old line for you. I got an old line. So I'm getting lines. Even Ryan was doing some spring cleaning at the Surrey shop, our other location, and he found like 4 XLTs. So he sent them over to me. And so what I do is I basically go out, get on my graph, and every foot, if I can, I find what I need. You know, I figure out I need it to taper from 0.45 to 0.46, let's say, over a foot. Well, I go through with a caliper through lines, and I find that piece, and I cut it out, and I label it, and I put it aside with a number on it. And then I go foot by foot, and I find every single piece that I need, and then I cut them all in a bias, and I super glue them all together. And so then what you have at that point is a line full of glue, which surprisingly doesn't matter as much as you think it would. But you have something that you can take down to the river and cast. And it's really like, especially now with supply chains being the way they are, it's really hard for major manufacturers, which are the people making your lines, if you have a little line company like this, to find a lot of time to do a ton of prototypes. So this is a really great way for me to make sure that something is at least viable before I go to my producer and say, hey, could you make a sample? And I can do a lot of tweaking, sort of cutting pieces out, putting pieces in, get back on the graph, look at the shape again, go down to the river, cast it again. And then when I get something pretty close to being workable, you approach the supplier. And so for me, finding the supplier, I found a great supplier. You know, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say it, but, Scientific Angler is my supplier, a bunch of great guys down there. Jeff Pierce, Josh Jenkins, two of my favorite people. You know, everyone else working there, I'm wonderful too. Those guys are my guys. Wonderful people making wonderful products, and certainly I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. And Dave Yeager, who works for Al Ballhumor, and they're kind of our local SA guys. They really opened that door to me. And Dave was just coming into the shop doing the rep thing and was asking me about, because I'm never like too quiet about this kind of stuff. So he was like, oh, what have you been up to? And I'm like, oh, I want to get these lines made. I think I want to do a line company. And he was like, well, have you ever thought about maybe getting them done at our place? And I was like, oh, you guys do that? And anyway, like, I really liked Jeff right away. And it just sort of went from there. And so then I had a supplier. And so, you know, they've been really good with being patient with me with all my questions. I mean, I'm learning as I go, just like anybody, right? So I think I just found the perfect producer with just wonderful people. And I don't know, it just sort of all fell into place. It started with just a really genuine interest in how fly lines work. And I think that just stemmed from a really genuine want or like need to learn more about casting and lines, which stemmed from tournament casting or came from that. So that's just sort of how it all happened. It just sort of seems to have been meant to be. It just seems to keep going. So it's good.
They would have known, obviously, that you had a mega potential, because that can't just be an open invitation to any Joe Blow. You know, obviously they had faith and confidence in you, which is huge. So rock on, SA. I'm impressed. What about materials, cores and plastic coatings and all of that stuff? Is there one set core nowadays, or do you have your choice between different materials?
No, I just go with the standard freshwater core, which is, I think, a 30-pound Dacron core. And I let the experts over there figure that stuff out. And I just work on the tapers, and that's it. I bet you probably could really get out of the box with densities and you know, different additives and stuff. But the materials that they use are just, they're so great as they are. And the performance of the lines has been so spectacular that I really haven't had any questions about it. So that's good, I guess.
Yeah. I think a lot of those guys are pretty quiet about how those lines are made. So I'd love to hear if any of those guys want to talk about it, I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. I'd imagine there's probably some trade secrets involved. I have no idea, but I send them the tapers. They send me the lines. It's been pretty good so far.
What about the whole shark skin thing? Did they give you the option? I know it's irrelevant really with spay casting, but did they mention that to you, the textured lines?
No, I think it is just irrelevant in spay casting. So just never something I touched on.
So on that note, do your lines have a loop-to-loop to their running line, or are they integrated?
They're loop-to-loop. Yeah, they're loop-to-loop.
What's your philosophy on that?
You know what I think it is? I think here in the Northwest, I think a lot of people started spay casting with heads. And so I've been working in the shop sort of long enough that I was around at the shop when Skagit lines came out. And I often refer, I think it was around 2006 or 2007, that first Rio original sort of Skagit line came out. And I always like talk about that, and I kind of call it like the Skagit revolution, because up until that point, spay casting was like something you didn't see very often. And a lot of people would try it and be like, oh man, this is really hard, right? And so when the Skagit line came out, like, I'm not even sure if I'd be sitting here if the Skagit line came out, you know. So many people, like, it just opened up an entire world. Spay casting exploded when Skagit lines came out. I don't think anyone can deny that. And so outside of the very first versions, we've all known Skagit heads to be shooting heads. And so I think here in the Pacific Northwest in particular, but probably in a lot of places in the world, we identify spay lines as being heads. Certainly in other, there's people who don't, and there's places where they still do a lot of integrated stuff. And there's certainly benefits and drawbacks to either of those systems. But for me, I always liked heads. And that probably just stems from spending so much time with heads. And you know, I was never a person really to grab one line system and be like, well, this is it. And if, you know, like, why would you fish anything else? This is the only thing you should fish. Why would you do this? And why would you do that? I really wanted to learn about everything. So I tried a little bit of everything. And at that time with Scandi and Skagit Heads, that's what was going on. And so I wanted to know as much as I could about that stuff and fish a lot of it. And of course, so for me, like spey lines just became sort of like heads. And then when I got into the tournament world, they're using heads there too. So when I started sort of buying, you know, when I sort of got more interested in some of this more modern long belly stuff and started buying like next cast lines, those were all heads. And so, yeah, it just seemed, yeah, I just saw the benefits of heads and I see for me more benefits than drawbacks. And the lines I made, it was a really selfish endeavor. They were the ones that I wanted and I wanted them to be heads. So, yeah. So that's what they've been.
I can't argue that. Yeah. What about the running line? Do you guys sell running line?
Yeah, I'm working on it. I've got a running line coming. I've got a shooting line coming and it's a mono shooting line. It's going to be, I think, 42 pound. So that's coming down. I don't know. I still have a bit of testing to do and have a look at it, but I've got a source on that. And I tested some samples and they were really good. So I've got something coming down the barrel on that. Nothing here yet, but certainly in the works for sure. And coming soon, I hope.
How do you stop a mono line from coiling without having to stretch it out all the time?
Oh, well, you got to stretch it. The number one, you got to stretch it. I think a lot of times it's how much you use it. And what kind of reel you're storing it on. So I love those old antique Hardy reels. I'm one of those guys. And so, you know, the arbors are pretty small on them. So after that thing sat for a few months and it's like the first one in the fall and you're yanking that thing off the reel on a crisp fall morning, it's looking a lot like a slinky. But I find, you know, you just live with it for a couple hours and just give it a good stretch. Right. And away you go. And as far as tangling goes, which is different, I guess, than the coils, but a lot of people find coils lead to tangling. Just hold loops properly. I made a video about it. You can watch it. I made it for you, April. So,
and Aaron filmed it.
So, yeah. So,
thank you for that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, just holding them properly, you know, just doing the things you can do to make sure they don't tangle. But at the end of the day, you got to stretch it. The longer it sits on a reel, the more stubborn it can be. But I will say that the ones that are out there today seem to be a lot better than the ones I originally encountered. So I find I give it a pretty good stretch. And it seems to be okay. The stuff's pretty good out there these days, it seems.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, we've just started doing this on video as well, the podcast, I mean. So yeah. Now that I can see you, and people will be able to see you if they go to the YouTube version, can I bug you to go through some casting steps and tips?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'd love to do that. Absolutely.
Okay, so the drift. Obviously, with the Skagit cast, I mean, most people listening at this point know typically short line, short stroke, long line, longer extended stroke. So with the Skagit line, obviously it's a pretty short, compact stroke. And so a lot of anglers, probably myself included for a while there, really cut ourselves short. Now, what about, we were talking about you just the other day, actually, about casting really long lines. And we were talking about what your drift would look like in a, say that you were casting, you said you like a 72 foot long head.
In tournament, sure. Yeah.
Sure. Can you, while we're sitting here and I can see you, we can see you, can you show us the difference with your arms and your hands on a Skagit line versus a 72 foot long head?
Yeah. I'm just going to turn my body here sideways so you can see it. So with a Skagit head, generally my hands would be right down around here. With a longer line, I'm probably up around here. And if you want, like, there's lots of video evidence of my horrible casting over the years because they film that thing down there. So if you watch me early on, I'm like this. I've got my hands like way like behind my head, and like I don't know how I was able to cast so far with some of the stuff I was doing. But nowadays I try and keep my hands in front, right about here. And if I drift up, I try not to get too much higher than about here. And the reason is I find that the more the bend comes out of this elbow as you come up, the less you're able to sort of use. If I had to put it like if I had a piece of drywall here and I was trying to put the bottom of my fist through it, I'd be a lot more powerful here than I am when this arm straightens out. Oh, I lose a lot of energy there. This isn't as a good a place to generate a straight line and good acceleration down here is. And so the other thing that can happen is if you get too high and this arm straightens out, you almost actually lose the ability to draw a straight line. And you start just actually bringing, you have nowhere to go but down essentially instead of straight. So for me, I don't like to get this too straight. Maybe about there would be the highest. But I like to have some bend in my elbow for sure.
So for people listening who aren't watching right now, Tim's talking about his elbow and it's extended out and it's still got bend in it, not just extended. Because if you lift up higher, it's going to straighten out and you're going to lose some strength. So when you come back though, so you've now just, say you've just formed your D-loop.
Sure.
So even at the height of your back cast, so at the very peak of your back cast, you still have your hands that far ahead of your face?
Oh yeah, hands in front. That was another hard one to learn. It took me a long time to learn that one. But you watch every great guy, Travis, Gerard, Tommy, hands in front. Yeah, hands in front. That's key for sure.
Right.
And, you know, through my exploration of the whole thing, and I'm not sure that I'm right. I mean, there's still a lot of things that are up in the air for me. Like I'm learning like everyone else. Every day I try and learn something about casting, get better. But my observations have been that when your hands are in front, number one, I find your anchor lands in a better place. So when you really jack your arms back and in behind, that can really direct your anchor in perhaps a different place than you'd want it to be. And generally for great casting, I want my anchor well in front of me. Okay. Less behind, more in front, both for fishing and for distance. Now when it comes to, the way you're going to apply the energy, the more that you push your hands back, the more you're probably going to drop your rod tip. So by keeping the hands in front like this, the rod tip stays much more upright. And so my observations through video is that if you get the rod super flat in the back cast, the rod doesn't really bend against the line until it gets probably about to 11 o'clock at the earliest. And then it's upright enough that the line starts pushing on it. But when it's flat like this, the line is sort of here and the rod's here and it's sort of coming up and it's not, your rod's not applying energy. It's not applying tension to the line just yet. So if you get really back and flat or even worse down from here to here is actually just wasted. Your slack's getting into the line right there. So for me, what I've found just by watching some of the videos that I've made of myself, that when I come back to here and I keep my hands in front like this, the very first motion that I make forward begins applying tension to the line. There's no wasted movement, right? And there's less slack getting into the line because of it.
Okay, two things. I just saw something there.
Okay.
Because I was going to ask how, if you cut yourself short, I'm just thinking about physics and timing and how that would work. Mm-hmm. But I saw you start to rotate your body. So are you maintaining your hands in this position, but utilizing your body to be able to complete your circle and your loop?
Yeah, that's a huge part of that's like a whole different fundamental of casting that I learned through tournament casting. And that's essentially using your body more than your arms and just understanding that your arms are a variable. And so the way I like to think about casting, and there's an instructor named Robert Gillespie, and he's from Ireland. And so when I first started getting into tournament casting, I started obviously Googling everything I could. And I hadn't been down there yet. And I came across his webpage, and it was called Casting Matters, which is this awesome name for a website. And so he had worked with a really great caster named Andrew Toft from Scotland as well. And he had just alluded to in his teachings that the rod, you know, a lot of people sort of cast with their arms and the rod's just along for the ride. And then there was a whole different mentality of thinking of the rod as a tool, setting the tool at the angle you want it to work at, and then locking up your arms, rotating your body, and letting the tool do what it's meant to do, right? So in the style that I like to use, a lot of lifts, people lift, when they lift, they do a shotgun lift. So they lift like this. So it's kind of what most of us have been taught to do.
Whereas just so people my listening lift, know, we're talking lifting at the very start of the cast, not lifting in your drift or anything.
Right. Totally. Initial lift. Sorry. Very, very beginning of any cast. And I'm going to use a single spay as an example. So that initial lift is kind of like a shotgun for most folks right here. And then as you would come around, you'd kind of rotate your body and sweep your arms around like this into position and then go from there. But of course, whenever you're rotating your body when you're using your arms like that, there can be dips and you can cut corners and you can drop your odd tip back here. And there's all kinds of things that can happen. The style that I kind of learned was, instead of lifting like a shotgun, you actually square the rod across your body this way. So I drop it down to my arms. And now the rod is facing out into the river instead of straight down. And so then the way I lift is I curl my arms up in front of me like this, like a barbell curl arm almost. And you'll notice that my two hands are in line with my shoulders. So I'm not lifting out like this or like this. These two hands are in line with my shoulders, and my top hand's going to come about eye level, and my lower hand is probably on about a 45 degree. I've got about a 45 degree tilt on the rod. If this was 90 and this was zero, probably about 45. Okay. And so I've got about a 90 degree bend in my arm right there. And this is where I like to lift to. And so at this point, when I get to the apex of that lift, I'm going to start rotating my body, right? And so what I like to do is, in this case, I'm casting with my right hand up the rod. So I'm going to point my right foot forward. My right foot is going to be forward, and it's going to be pointing at the target. And what that right foot being forward is going to do is it's going to restrict the amount of rotation I can do. So if I have my left foot forward, I can rotate so far past where I want to go. But if I use that right foot forward and it's pointing towards the target, it cuts me off. It makes it so I can only rotate basically to the point that my two hands are in line with his leg. And so now I've got my right foot forward pointed at the target. I've lifted up my arms like this right here. And now I'm ready to rotate my body. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rotate my body and keep my arms locked. Okay, right to here. Now I'm going to lock my arms and turn back. Does this look familiar? This is a really good firing position. So I want you to see that there's no difference between the firing position and where I have you lift to. So the lift becomes the firing position, and the firing position is the lift, right? And so what that does is it takes a ton of errors out of casting. We're not talking about you dropping your rod tip anymore. We're not talking about your hands being in front. We're not talking about cutting corners. We're not talking about dipping your rod tip. We're not talking about anything but keep your arms still and turn your body. And so with a short line, when I lift to here and I lock my arms and I rotate to be in line with this right foot, I'll have my hands down here. But with a long line, when I come around and get to here, this isn't high enough. So once my rotation's finished, I do bring my arms up a little bit, right? And that just, you know, helps accommodate that longer line. You need a little bit more height, right? And so that can be applied to a lot of different casts. So if you want to do a parry poke, you might lift, come around, dump the line, then lift like this, lock your arms and turn, and fire forward. Snap T or circle spay or C spay or whatever you call it, up and under, up and lock, turn to face, cast. So there's a lot of like that whole style that I learned through tournament casting. I guess maybe we got pretty far away from where we started this whole thing, but that's really changed the way I cast and the way I teach, and it's made a big difference for a lot of people that I teach to.
Big time. So I mean, just the amount of errors that it removes is beneficial in itself.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, less injuries. There's a ton of reasons why it makes sense. Sure. But what about with short lines then? Would you just do that same thing, but with a shorter body movement?
Yeah. Or lower hands, right?
Lower hands.
So right. If I want my firing position to be down here, say I'm using like an OPST commando head or something, well, then I only lift to here because then by when I turn, that's my firing position. But with a longer line, I may want my hands to, well, I'm going to probably drift for a longer line. So that's going to happen after my rotation. But to get a 70 plus foot head to turn the corner, initially, I'm going to have to lift higher to get more line off the water before I turn. Right. So if you watch some of the, like now that I've passed that on to you, if you watch a lot of the tournament videos, you'll see that style. That's like, you'll see that it's something that, that's pretty prevalent for sure.
This is great. So you utilize a closed stance then?
I do. Yeah, I do.
But with a single hand casting in the tournament world, do they have a closed stance? No, they're usually open, right?
I don't know. I think that's something I've never done. I know for me, when I single hand cast, I like an open stance because I like to be able to look at my back cast pretty easily. So that's how I do it. I find if I stand closed, it can be hard to look at it, but I'm sure... I mean, there's guys that spay cast in tournaments with open stance that do really well. But for me, because I know I'm going to screw up, I want the most parachutes, exit plans, safety plans, whatever you want to call it, that I can have. And so, you know, I kind of came to the conclusion a long time ago that if I'm competing... it's going to be a bad day of casting. So the least I could do is make it easy on myself and do it the easiest way I know how. So
that's good. That's a good motto. And then my second question about all of that is that, because I would have assumed that you had to have your hands farther back, not behind your head, but certainly closer to your ear. Mm-hmm. Because to allow for an obviously, you know, wider trajectory, because obviously if you have too short of a stroke, then you're going to end up with the concave and the rest of that disaster.
Yeah, for sure.
So where is your forward cast? But I guess if you're, even though your hands are here, if your raw tip is still pointing back, where's your forward cast going?
Straight. So the rod's an amplifier, right? So for
straight,
straight if we can, hopefully. But, yeah. So for me to get my rod back to where I need it to be, I don't need my hands to be behind me, right? And this is a really hard thing for me to learn. And you'll see too, like everyone's got varying degrees of it, right? But for me, this is where I like to be. And the more in front my hands are, the better a cast I get. And so my cast coming from here is hopefully like this right here, right?
So you still have a bend in your arm then. So hang on. So are you controlling the trajectory and controlling how far back that raw tip goes with your bottom hand?
Yeah, that's definitely absolutely. So if my lower hand is in like this, obviously the rod's going to be straight, right? If I have my arm or my lower hand extended, that's got more of, it's got probably a better angle for trajectory, right there. So yeah, you never want your firing position to be too upright because if you're at noon, there's nowhere to go but down. And then usually you're going to, because your stroke length's been cut in half, you're probably going to apply the energy in a very abrupt sort of fashion. And that obviously a downward trajectory and a tailing loop that's about as far as a cast can fall, right? So, yeah. So having, you know, I like the thought of sort of like 10 to 2, the same thing that we teach in you know, I was saying 11 before, but probably it's probably around 10 o'clock or so that it kind of somewhere back in here, right? I don't stand in a clock vase very often. So
I'd say it's 2. I'd say it's 2 o'clock for sure.
Sure. 10 and 2. Same sort of deal for sure. But yeah, when I'm out here and I'm in front, when I have this lower hand all the way extended, I'm getting the angle that I need. And then the great thing about having this lower hand extended is you get a really long path to pull that lower hand in and apply energy. So a lot of people, they have a firing position where it's in like this, and people always say use your lower hand. But if you just have this, you've got nowhere to go. So by getting this out, like in the best guys, they get it way out. They get it straight and just boom, right? They get the full draw on the entire thing.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. I wish that I know there's some people listening right now who can't see it and they're probably cursing me, but where are we at? So when you're watching the episode or when you go to look it up on YouTube, just skip to around an hour and 10 and it should bring you there. Can people book you for lessons now still?
Yeah, for sure. Pretty easy to find. I mean, if you go to the Bridge website, you certainly can just use the contact form there. I'm the guy answering the emails. I see all of them. So if you're looking for a lesson, please feel free to reach out. And I teach all the time. So always.
When's your next workshop? Because sorry to cut you off. This is going to be live in a couple of weeks. When's your next workshop?
I don't have anything group planned at the moment. I just do a ton of private lessons. And but I do like group lessons too. They can be hard. I guess too, the last couple of years with COVID and you know, you can't have a group thing and this and that. I'm probably gonna have to get more into a mindset of doing that. I've been out to Calgary a couple times since the whole thing's turned. Josh, your friend Josh, my friend Josh Nugent, great guy, out fly fishing outfitters in Calgary. He definitely brings me out a couple times a year to do group schools there. And I usually go once in the spring and once in the sort of late summer to get all our Alberta friends in shape to go to the Skeena and fish for steelhead or do trout spay on the home rivers. But yeah, no, I don't do a ton of big schools. I like to work with people one-on-one. That tends to be the way I prefer to do it, but certainly do schools as well. But
no, it's the best. All right. And how can people find you, Tim?
I guess the website number one, and then this is pretty bad. I'm actually gonna have to look at my phone.
Bridge Instagram. I tried looking up your, because I was like, is it 6 M's or 4 Y's? I was trying to find a Tim Me.
It's gone. Yeah.
I figured it was gone.
It's gone. Yeah. I didn't use it. I just didn't update it. I just didn't, it was just a thing in life that didn't have to be there. And so I took it away, and so now it's bridge_116.2, and that's sort of the thing. And if you're wondering, I get this question a lot. If you're wondering what the 116.2 is, yes. The logo has a bridge in it, and it looks a lot like any BC sort of famous train bridge. But in particular, that bridge is the bridge over the Telqua on the Bulkley. And so when I first started with the idea of bridge, I didn't have anyone to help me with my logo. So I ran down to the library and I got like, you know, 8 books on classic logo design. And then I got Illustrator on my computer. I didn't know what I was doing. And I watched some YouTube videos. And so I was looking for, I knew I wanted a bridge and I knew I couldn't draw one. So I found this picture of the Telqua Bridge and I just traced it. And so, later on, my really good buddy, John MacArthur, who did my packaging and did the logo as well. He kind of tweaked the logo. And so what he found out was when, if you go to the bridge in Telqua, there's a CN number stamped into it and it's 116.2. So that's why it's on the package. That's why it's in the name. That's sort of the bridge that started the whole logo and everything. So that's the little Easter egg. I got tons of questions. So I figured maybe I should clear the air while I'm well, I'm here with you. Get that out of the way.
I love it. And I love that bridge. So that's super cool. I'll never drive over it the same way again. Now I see it.
Go. Yeah, totally. You see the numbers if you go over it, right? So it's there. Yeah.
Cool. Well, look, I know you're at the shop. That's the other thing. Could people still find you at Michael and Young?
Yeah, here all the time. Almost never not here.
At the Vancouver correct, yeah. Location. Yeah. Don't go to Surrey. They'll be so disappointed.
No, they get Ryan. That's great, too. Yeah.
I know he's great, too. But if they went looking for you and they drive an hour out.
Yeah, if you were looking for me, then yeah. Yeah, you've got Catherine and Ryan over there right now. So that's a good place to be, too. No question.
Yeah, either location, you'll end up in good hands.
You're in good hands, either way you go.
I'll link all this, but just for people listening, if they wanted to check it out right now, what's the website?
Yeah, www.bridgeoutfitting.com. Well, wait a minute. Let me just double check. This is so bad. Oh, I'm such an idiot.
I will link everything. But it's just, it's so...
No, it is. It's bridgeoutfitting.com. That's what it is. Yeah. that's actually the name. Yeah.
I love it, Tim, because you are really... This truly is. This isn't like you're some crazy cutthroat businessman who's trying to cash in on this. You really are so genuine and so pure, and I just think that I think it's a perfect fit. I'm honestly very proud of you. I'm excited to try one of these lines.
Means a lot coming from you. And you know, when I ordered all these lines to begin with, you know, it's always like this moment of horror when you actually pay for everything and it shows up. And I remember dragging these boxes of lines into the house and Lisa looking at me like, what the hell? And I open the box and there's just like, you know, 800,000 grains of spay lines in one of these boxes. And so I'm looking at it and I look up at her and I go, well, if people don't buy them, I'll never buy a spay line again. I'm good for life at this point. We can't lose. We're going to save spay line money forever at this point. So,
are shops buying them? In America,
yeah.
Are the shops buying
yeah.
them?
Oh, yeah. They go all over. I've sold a lot of lines in Japan, lots in the States. Emerald Waters Angling is my dealer in the U.S. And Dave's a great guy. Up here, I've got Robinson's Victoria, Michael and Young, obviously, Sea Run Flying Tackle. We've got Josh, Fly Fishing Outfitters in Alberta. Then I've got Flymart.ca, Scott Curry out in Ontario. And yeah, between those guys, like, they're shipping lines all over. So that's been pretty cool. And yeah, I'm looking forward to continuing working with those guys. And I'm just really lucky to have such a fantastic sort of network of dealers. Oh, Oscars and Smithers. How could I forget, Alex at Oscars, wonderful guy, you know, can't say enough about all the folks that have supported me on this journey. Certainly it couldn't have happened without them and the great folks at SA, and, you know, James showing me how to measure lines, and Aaron taking pictures, and John with logos, and just my buddy Zach with his input and art. And it's just been, I've just been super lucky to be surrounded by just such a great group of folks, and talented too. I mean, certainly I'm really lucky to have friends that are good at stuff. and we've had a lot of fun doing this thing together. It's been great, right? So it's been awesome.
I love it. All right, well, we'll wrap it up. Thank you very much for coming to the show, and enjoy your travel home. What time is it there?
It is 7:43. So it's not too late. I still got dinner to cook, but that's okay. We'll make it. I'll whip something up quick.
Awesome. All right, well, thanks again, Tim.
Thank you, April. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week when I sit down with Van Rooster Levens.